The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddhist truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So in the course of this talk, I will be talking about the ceremony a bit. And so for those of you who are new, we'll give you a little bit of information about what you've just done. And we do this ceremony, the Feeding of the Hungry Ghosts, at Halloween and also at the spring and autumn equinoxes. And these ceremonies are called Ohigen in Japan. And in Japan, they just do them at the fall and spring equinoxes. These are the times of the year when light and darkness are equal, when the seasons change from winter to spring and spring to summer. And it is said that this is the time when beings have the most opportunity for change. So it's very fitting to do it for the hungry ghosts. It is the wish of all Buddhists that beings be at peace and know the immaculacy of the Buddha nature. Nothing is rejected. All beings in all aspects of ourselves are respected and seen to be a part of the unborn Buddha nature. At this ceremony, we offer ourselves to help all beings who have died, and especially those who have died in tragic or disturbing circumstances, or who are in unfortunate states of existence. We offer our hands, our voices, our meditation, the preparation of the different kinds of food to help these unfortunate beings cross over to the other shore. And I'll be talking more about what this means. And that's actually the main focus of my talk, is crossing over to the other shore. The history of this, of the ceremony of Sagaki, is found in the Ulambana Sutra. And I've taken the brief description that I'm going to give you from an article in our journal on Mogayana and his mother. The Sagaki ceremony, or the Feeding of the Hungry Ghost ceremony, is one of the oldest Buddhist festivals, and it originated at the time of Shakyamuni Buddha. Venerable Mogayana was one of the Buddha's chief disciples, and he wished to help his deceased parents. He had a vision in which he saw that his mother had fallen into the realm of the hungry ghosts. Being without food or drink, she had become very thin. Mogayana immediately tried to give his mother food from his alms bowl, but as she tried to eat the food, it turned to charcoal. According to Buddhist belief, beings fall into the state of a hungry ghost because their deeds of greed are very serious. Mogayana's mother, when receiving the food, tried to cover it over with her left hand so that none of the other hungry ghosts would see it and want it. And this made it not possible for her to even get the food. And this is probably why she ended up in the state of a hungry ghost in the first place, this attitude of mind. So Mogayana, who was a human being, even though he was a great disciple, and still had feelings, was very sad. And he went to the Buddha and asked him what he could do about this. And the Buddha explained to Mogayana that his mother was in the woeful state because her past offenses had been very great. He also told him that his mother could not be saved through Mogayana's individual effort alone. What was needed was the power of the whole Sangha, the merit of the whole Sangha. So he told him to prepare a feast and other offerings for the monks, and all the monks would offer merit for his mother. And this is what he did, and he later had a vision that his mother had left the realm of the hungry ghosts. So this is the origin of the ceremony. It started a long time ago, and it's been going ever since. For those of you who have never heard the word hungry ghost, it's considered one of the three lower realms of existence. Greed, envy, and jealousy can lead to rebirth as a hungry ghost. Hungry ghosts suffer the torments of hunger because their bellies are huge and their throats are very thin. So this is how they're depicted. And so that they can't receive food. They want a lot, but they can't receive anything. And my understanding of a hungry ghost is that it's a... And we all have aspects of hungry ghost within us, or most of us do. And my sense of what a hungry ghost is it's, or an aspect of ourselves, is something that does not believe that it is worthy, and does not believe that it could have something within, that it could have Buddha nature. And so is constantly looking outside of him or herself, grabbing onto things, trying to get things, trying to get external things to fill oneself up. And it comes from not knowing any better, not knowing that you have everything within you, inside you, that we all have Buddha nature, and that we can find it through doing this practice, through letting go, through doing the training. But when we don't know that and we feel totally lacking, then we look outside ourselves. And I think some people have more of this than others, and perhaps it's because they inherited the karma from someone whose deeds of greed were very serious. And some of the aspects of a hungry ghost that arise from time to time are feelings of unworthiness, desperate need to have something, needing to control things or have things only be your way, jealousy, inadequacy, doubts. But what arises from time to time, if we have this as part of our makeup, is not our true nature. It's just something that arises and passes if we allow it to pass. As we have done in this ceremony, we offer the hungry ghost karma within ourselves, our love, our acceptance, and the teaching, which is the medicine that cures all ills. We allow it to arise, and we allow it to pass, and we don't act from it. I remember when I was new monk here and I first saw these aspects of myself, I was horrified, and I thought there was something really wrong with me, and I hated it, and I just wanted it to go away. But if we can look at it as not something that is bad or wrong with us, but just one of the many things that arises and passes, and again, needs our love and acceptance. And we can train with it and help that karma by when greeds arise, you know, the need to have something. You know, we've all had this feeling from time to time. I absolutely have to have something. And, you know, an extreme example of this is when someone loves someone else, and they're very jealous, and then the other person goes off with someone else, and they're so jealous and so needy that they go off and shoot the person. And this is an extreme example of greed being serious. But it's this feeling of lacking something and needing to get something from somewhere else and feeling like we need to have this. And these feelings that arise can be very compelling, and it can seem like I really need to have that. And for me, when I used to have this come up, I would want to go to other people and have them reassure me, or give me something, or somehow fill me up, which we don't actually need to be filled up, because we're empty already, and that emptiness is just perfect just as it is. But now when it arises, I try to just let it be there and sit with it. And when it goes, to let it go. Reverend Master Echo describes this as allowing it to arise, abide, change, and pass away. This is what happens with all our thoughts and feelings. And we can allow this to happen with those feelings of inadequacy or neediness, or any of those other feelings that come up. And the important thing is not to judge it. As we didn't judge the ghost today that we were offering merit to, we were just wanting to help them. Then we shouldn't judge ourselves when these aspects of ourselves arise. I was listening to a tape that Reverend Master Jiyu gave Reverend Master Jiyu Kennett, who was the first abbess here, on Sagaki, and she was talking about this other ceremony that happens at this one temple in Japan where they do a Sagaki first. And in that tape, she said, we're all hungry ghosts yearning for the eternal, longing to return to the eternal. And hearing it in that way, it was so bright and positive that you can see, if you think of the hungry ghost in that way, it's just something longing to return to the eternal, then you can see it in a more positive light. Now, in relation to this ceremony, we often talk about the six realms of existence, which are the three higher realms are the devas, or the heavenly beings, the human beings, the asuras, which are those beings who are very much caught up in fame and gain and wanting to get ahead in the world, and the three lower realms as the realms of the hungry ghost, the hells, and the animals. And the six realms of existence, sometimes you're reborn into, this will get very complicated, so I won't go too far in that direction, but sometimes it's just states of mind that go on in our lives at different times of the day or different times in our lives. And they're caused by the three poisons of greed, anger, and delusion. They're not permanent states. And I'd like to read to you from the Litany of Bodhidharma, because I like the way that he describes these six realms of existence. Greed is the world of desire. Hatred is the world of form. And delusion is the world beyond form. It is because of these three attitudes that we bind ourselves to the fulfillment of the karmic recompense from our evil deeds. And Buddhism doesn't see things as evil, although we use that word. It's just mistaken deeds that create suffering, and ceaselessly spin about on the wheel of rebirth. Thus they are called the three worlds. The karma created from the three poisons is either more or less grievous, so that the realms as perceived are not all alike, but divide up and revert to the six abodes of perception, which are therefore called the six realms. Ekka asked, this is Bodhidharma's disciple, how do these more or less grievous conditions divide into the six? Bodhidharma replied, if a sentient being does not comprehend the true cause of his karma, yet cultivates what is good with his mind in delusion, he will not escape the three worlds, but will give rise to the three less grievous realms. What are these three? 1. If someone thoroughly cultivates the 10 virtues whilst vainly chasing after pleasures, he will not escape from the world of greed, and we will be reborn in the realm of the devas. So the realm of the devas, or the heavenly beings, is not a final state. It's just one of the realms that we go in and out of. And sometimes it's said that you can learn more, you have the greatest potential for change in the world of human beings because there's so much suffering here. Whereas the realm of the devas is so pleasant that beings don't want to change. And for those of you who have gone through very difficult times, you know that it's in those difficult times that you really want to change. But when things are going well, there's more of a tendency to just go along with it until it kind of passes away. 2, if he fully keeps to the five precepts so as not to kill, steal, covet, lie, or sell the wine of delusion, whilst vainly giving rise to attachments and hatred, he will not evade the world of anger and will be reborn in the realm of humans. 3, If he deludedly clings to the phenomenal world, trusts in false views, and chases after good fortune and blessings, he has not yet escaped from the world of delusion and will be reborn as an asura. Such are the three types, called the three less grievous. What are the three more grievous ones? If someone pursues the three poisonous attitudes simply to promote evil deeds, he will fall into the three more grievous realms. So these are ones that we purposely do things. One, if the deeds arising from his greed are serious, he will fall into the realm of the hungry ghosts. Two, if the deeds arising from his anger are serious, he will fall into the realm of the hells. Three, if the deeds arising from his delusion are serious, he will fall into the realm of the animals. In this way, the three more grievous ones, along with the three less grievous realms, comprise the six realms. Understand, therefore, that all the karma of suffering is produced by one's own attitudes of mind. But if one is able to keep his thoughts from wandering off, that is, do meditation, allow things to arise and pass, whilst abandoning the false and the wicked, not chasing after things and believing in them and going along with them, the karma which has been sending him spinning through the three worlds and the six realms will spontaneously evaporate. For this ability to eliminate one's suffering is what is called liberation. So this is something that we can all do. In regards to greed, anger, and delusion arising, they arise for all of us. And there's nothing wrong with them arising, but our training is to just let them arise, abide, change, and pass. So this ceremony is done at the spring and autumn equinoxes because perhaps these times offer the greatest opportunities for the ghosts to change. And this ceremony isn't magic. It entices the ghosts by offering them foods of all different kinds. Also, money is thrown about to offer them money if that's where their greed lies. I don't know if you noticed that there's hands on the altar. They were there, weren't they, the hands? I'm sure they were there. Well, are they still there? Oh, I can't see them. Okay. Hands on the altar because perhaps some ghosts don't have hands. So we're offering our hands to help the ghost. So this is an incredibly compassionate ceremony to help beings no matter what state they may be in. All different kinds of food are offered. Sweet foods, sour foods, salty foods, liquids, dry foods, wet foods. So that no matter what the ghost likes, he or she will be enticed to come. And then when the ghosts come, we give them the teaching. We give them the Dharma, which is really what they long for. And we are all offering merit at this ceremony. We're offering, you know, we're all singing the invocations, the scriptures. When the celebrant and the senior officers asperge, you know, when they asperge the water, they are assuring the ghosts, they're offering them water to drink, but they're also assuring the ghosts of their immaculacy. And when they offer incense, they are offering the smell of lotus blossoms, or the teaching, the perfume of the teaching, so that the ghosts will be enticed to give up their delusions. But then it's up to the ghosts whether they want to change or not. So this is where we come to this picture. And this is a picture of three Chinese monks, which are over here, doing the Sagaki ceremony. And if you come up afterwards, you'll see this. It's really a lovely picture because you can see all the ghosts marching down to the altar. And in the center of the altar, this is Yama, who is the Lord of the Dead. And in his hands is a jewel. And it's the same jewel that Kishtigarbha Bodhisattva carries. It's the Mani jewel. And it's the jewel of enlightenment, the jewel of immaculacy. And the jewel is coming down to the altar. And the altar is full of food that they've offered. And the hungry ghosts are taking, many of them are listening, many are taking away the food, many are eating the food, and the food looks just like the jewel, what's coming from the jewel. So they've come for the food, but they've really gotten the jewel of the Dharma. And then there's one ghost over here carrying the scripture, and he's the one who really got it. He's the one who really heard the teaching and has turned his heart around. And this is what we're hoping for, that, you know, sometimes you hear the teaching and you're not quite ready for it. So it's planted a seed, but you're not quite ready to put it into practice. And then you may come again, and then at some point you're really willing to hear. So even the gakis who have just gone off with the food and aren't really listening, they've heard something, and it's planted a seed that may one day allow them to really listen and hear and realize that they are not unworthy, that they can let go and return to the unborn, because that is their true wish. So besides offering the food and the ceremonial, we're offering our faith and our certainty in the Buddha nature. And this is what truly helps beings. This is what helps us get started in this practice, is seeing the faith and the certainty of someone who's doing the training. And you see that there is something real. And there's that joy in finding that there is something, or just the relief that there is something else. And and Reverend Master, again, I was listening to all different kinds of tapes and things, trying to get information on Sagaki. At another tape where she was talking to the monks after a Sagaki ceremony, she said that this was the best Sagaki she'd ever been to. The ghosts were really filled with joy. And because of the care that was taken in preparing the food, and because of the ceremony and all the care that had been taken for their benefit, and again, this can be related to the joy of first finding the teaching. And the joy when our heart opens, even just a little bit, to what is truly there. And if the hungry ghosts can turn their heart around, surely we can do the same. Now, ohigen, in Japanese, ohigen is the name of the festival in Japan, means crossing over to the other shore, or crossing the sea of suffering. And we cross the sea of suffering by hearing the teaching, contemplating the teaching, but most importantly, putting the Buddhist teaching into practice. And the other shore is not somewhere over there. The other shore is within us. And we cross the other shore, we cross the sea of suffering by doing the training and letting go of that which obscures it. So letting go of our greed, anger, and delusion, and doing the practice allows us to cross the sea of suffering and find it within ourselves. We can always make vows to deepen our training. And Reverend Master Echo gave a wonderful Dharma talk on January 1st of this year on making vows. And I don't know if any of you remember that, for those of you who were here. But the spring and autumn equinoxes can also be times of making vows. You can make them any time, but this seems like a good time when there's said to be the greatest ability to change. It's a good time to contemplate the teaching, to renew our vows, and also to study the paramitas, which I'll talk about later. I remember when Reverend Master talked about making vows, that I decided to make a vow that I would keep true to what I knew to be right, to what I knew to be true. Sometimes we know within ourselves, through our training or just through intuition or through having some experience of the truth, what is truly good to do. And we get pulled off by it, by greed, by anger, by delusion, by all the many aspects of ourself. And I made this vow because, and I've told some of you this, when I became the prior or the director, which is a very busy job and active, and in January of 2005, and I had this wish that that I would be able to sit still within all conditions. That no matter what was going on in the monastery, no matter what someone came in and told me, or no matter what I had to work out or sort out, I would stay still, I would allow my thoughts to come and go, and then I would just act from my Buddha nature. And this is what I had hoped to do, but I was quite surprised when going from a very simple job, which I was doing before, where I worked alone, to being with people all the time and working with them, that many aspects of my koan and myself arose with a vengeance that I may not have been aware of. And I found myself acting from it. And this was not my intention. And so I made this vow that I would really try to do this, or maybe I was more realistic at this point that I might not, you know, be so successful all the time. But I wanted to try because it's keeping true to our intention that helps others and also helps us find the cessation of suffering. And we don't find it in a void. By avoiding all the things that bother us and give us difficulties, but we find it through learning how to train with others and with situations. And and you know, we make mistakes and we fall down, but I think the important thing is that we're willing to keep on going. And in Reverend Master Eckhart's talk last January, he did say there was merit in trying. So I like to think that, you know, all the efforts that we do make, even though we fail from time to time, is very helpful. In the scripture of the Buddha's last teaching, which mentions several times in it being ferried to the other shore and ferrying all beings to the other shore, he talks to his disciples about, you know, ferrying beings to the other shore. It says, if you are diligent in your devotion to progress, and one understanding of devotion to progress can be letting go of the resistance to training, which is often what makes it so difficult to train. Training will not be difficult for you. Therefore, be diligent and devote yourselves to progress, just as a small stream, ever flowing, can bore holes in rocks. And one of the things that can dampen our progress is always listening to and believing in the self and being pulled down by it and constantly going back into our suffering. You know, if we feel, and this would pertain to kind of hungry ghost karma, where we feel we're constantly feeling unworthy and wretched, and everything we try fails, and then we listen to it, and we believe in it, and then we just go sink right down into it. But we can just let it come and go and train with it and not always get pulled down into it. I had a very interesting dream a couple weeks ago, which actually pertains to my vow. I didn't realize it until I started doing this talk, but I will relate it to you. I was walking through a town, and whenever someone entered this town, it was very difficult for them to leave. And it was because the people in the town found ways of keeping them there, and it was very difficult to get past these people. And I remember walking down the street, and there were people on either side of me who were trying to scare me. And I became immovable, that I couldn't get out of the town because they were scaring me that if I moved, something horrible would happen. And then someone came who had left the town, or just some being from the other side of the town, came back into the town and walked with me. And I saw that if I didn't look from side to side, I could just walk straight through the town, and the beings couldn't harm me. And then I was outside the town, and then I found myself back in the town. And this time I saw that my face was all distorted, and I found that the longer you stayed in the town, the more you became distorted, because the town was full of luring you with your greeds and fears. And we somehow know that when we give in to our feeds and greers, that's an interesting greeds and fears, that we do become distorted because we're not seeing clearly at that time. And lo and behold, I found I could walk out of the town again. And I think I was actually taking other people out with me at this point. And there was one woman I remember who was having a very difficult time, but she was getting out. And then as soon as she got out of the town, somebody handed her this large candy bar. And she gave in to greed, and she was back in the town. So when you lose your true purpose and give in to things that you know are not good for you to give in to, and I know that this isn't easy, you're back in the town. So so this dream fits in for me with keeping the vow of keeping true to what I know to be true and not giving in to fears, doubts, and greed. And then I'd like to relate something that I think is similar to this. Was a movie that River Master Jiyu showed us in the early days of the monastery. And she would often find movies that other people wouldn't see had teaching in them, and see the teaching in them and show them to us. And this movie, I think, had a lot of teaching in it. And it was called The Thief of Baghdad. And in the film, there was a king who called all his wise men to the court and asked them what was the most valuable thing in the world, what was the most important thing in the world. And whoever could bring him that thing would have his daughter in marriage. And forgive me if I have the story slightly off. I'm not sure of the exact details. So they all went out looking for the most important thing, and they came back with all kinds of different things. And the first wise man brought back something called the Horn of Plenty, which never ran out of food and could feed the world. And I think the other wise men brought similar kind of, you know, incredible things like that. And the last wise man to speak, who was the wisest of them all, said that the most important thing was the all-seeing eye, or universal wisdom. And he said he couldn't go to find it because he was too old. And he also said that that it was very, what did he say? The journey was seriously dangerous, and that the path was very narrow, and that if you swayed from the path, you were immediately turned to stone. So our hero in this movie was Roddy McDowell, for those of you who may know Roddy McDowell. And he was the thief. And he was this very unscrupulous character who just enjoyed the pleasures of life and enjoyed his thieving and was very cynical and skeptical and didn't care about very much except, you know, enjoying things. He somehow ended up doing this journey. And for anyone who takes this journey, they arrive at this door. And the gatekeeper at the door tells them how perilous the journey is, and that if you step off it, off the path, that you will be turned to stone. And so everybody who's ever reached this door has turned away. Well, that's not right. Most people who have reached this door have turned away, and but those who have entered have all turned to stone. Because what arises when you enter this path is everything about yourself, you know, comes at you. It's like Mara, your past wrongs, your fears, your worries are all kind of on either side of the path, and they're trying to pull you off the path. But the thief says, oh, what the heck, you know, I'll give it a try. And once he enters the path, he actually becomes very serious. And things arise, and he stays on the path, and then something very important from his past is over at the side, and someone is crying out for his help. And he's just about to leave the path, and they say, oh, then he realizes, and he doesn't. And he, you know, he tells this being that he's sorry, but he can't leave the path. And once he's made this decision, everything else that comes up is not a problem for him. And I actually remember that he laughs at all the other things. And he makes it to the all-seeing eye, and he's able to take it back to the king. So it was the unscrupulous thief that was able to find the truth, because he stuck to it. And so this shows us that any of us can do this practice, no matter what we've done in the past, no matter what we are like right now, we can turn our hearts around. And there is no judgment in Buddhism. Now, meditation can be like being on this path where thoughts and feelings arise, and some thoughts and feelings arise, and they're very easy to let just arise and pass. And then something comes up that's very compelling, something you're very worried about, something that's disturbing to you, and you leave your meditation and you're off the path. Our karmic habits or patterns, our emotions, our thoughts can seem real and right and be very compelling. With greed, as I mentioned before, we may feel that we have to have something. Anger and frustration can seem justified, and despair can be very real, can seem very real. But we don't have to follow them. We can sit still in the midst of them. And this is... it's a long, hard journey, and we fall down many times, and we can pick ourselves up because we don't turn to stone when we leave the path. Fortunately for us, we can just pick ourselves up and keep on going. So I like that story. It's good teaching. I was worried that this talk would only be 10 minutes, so now I'm worried that it's going to be too long. but I'm almost done. So there are other vows that we can make on this day or at other times. The Japanese word higen, which forms the word ohigen, comes from the Sanskrit word paramita, which means that which reached the other shore. So that's very fitting for this day. The paramitas, or perfections, are the virtues perfected by a bodhisattva as he or she trains themselves. And as Reverend Master Eckho has many times said, and I think it's also in the scripture of Brahmanet, we are all bodhisattvas new to training. So those of us who have stepped onto the path and have decided to do this practice are included in this as bodhisattvas new to practice. And I found in the Shambhala Dictionary of Buddhism and Zen, just some brief descriptions of the six paramitas, which I think are very fitting for this day and for my vow as well. The six paramitas are dana paramita, or generosity, shila paramita, which they call discipline, we call the precepts, kshanti paramita, patience, virya paramita, energy or exertion or right effort, jhana paramita, which is meditation, prajna paramita, which is wisdom. And then further down, he explains a bit more about these paramitas. Dana paramita consists of beneficence and giving in both the material and spiritual sense. This includes being compassionate and kind and not keeping accumulated merit for oneself, but rather dedicating it to the liberation of all beings, which is very fitting for this ceremony today. Shila Paramita includes proper behavior conducive to the eradication of all passions and the securing of a favorable rebirth for the sake of liberating all beings. So this is what we call the precepts, keeping the precepts. Kshante Paramita refers to the patience and tolerance that arise from the insight that all the problems of beings have causes. I really like that one. And we can include ourselves in this, that the reason we are as we are, there are reasons for this, and we can be kind and compassionate to ourselves with our difficulties. Virya Paramita is resolute effort that does not permit itself to be diverted by anything. So this is kind of fits in with my vow. I didn't know it was a paramita, but that's kind of nice. Jhana Paramita here means meditation as the way of cutting through the illusion of an ego and of not experiencing oneself as separate from other beings. And Prajna Paramita is a realization of supreme wisdom. And in doing a search on the internet for the meaning of O'Hagan, which this search was not very successful, which I find most of my internet searches are not very successful. And I usually give them up before I ever find what I'm looking for. I did see that the six paramitas for some temples was associated with the ceremony of O'Hagan and studying the six paramitas, reflecting on them. And the six paramitas are that which liberate, which carries us to the other shore. There is a nice illustration of the paramita of generosity in the following. Beings in hell are unable to eat because they have a really long spoon and they can't get it into their mouths. But beings in heaven can eat. They have the same spoon, but they help each other. I thought that was very nice. Shakyamuni Buddha encouraged his monks to help, and one of the monks said a couple of days ago, let us walk to the other shore together. We are all training together, we are all interdependent, and we are all helping each other through our faith, our generosity, our diligence, and so on. Buddhas and bodhisattvas are helping us also. Let us all walk on the way to enlightenment with all living beings.